Thank you, Mr. Pavlik, and good afternoon to all of you. Appreciated Mr. Patchinger taking the time in the announcements today to mention all who certainly have required and asked for our prayers. He himself was on that list at one time or another here in the last month, as all of you know. And it just seems that sometimes these things be a little cyclical and come and go. Even the one in the bulletin is connected to us. Carson Fultz is our daughter-in-law, Krista's grandfather. So certainly we are more than aware of that situation as well. And there just seem to be so many who do need God's intervention as he sees fit and as he wills, and to need us to be aware of the plight and bringing our petitions to him as well. I'd like to talk about something today related to the season of the year we're in, as we've now moved past Thanksgiving. Did anybody else notice? It certainly struck me this year how relieved people all around us seem to be now that they can focus unashamedly on Christmas once they've gotten past Thanksgiving and gotten this Thanksgiving thing out of the way. Now, maybe people wouldn't say it that way, but certainly the focus in our society has been morphing and changing for probably more than 100 years. I mean, reading some historical accounts, from everything I can determine, Thanksgiving appears to have been actually a bigger deal in the middle or late 19th century, the year that century that ended in the year 1900, those 100 years. It seems to have been a bigger deal back then in the 1800s for the most part than Christmas was. But then that was before the days of commercialization and the streamlining and the focused attention on what Americans do so well, make money, or they like to think they can make money anyway. Of course, there's always the get-rich-quick schemes and all those zero-sum things when for every winner there's a loser. And for everybody who makes $100, somebody loses $100 somewhere, and that seems to be a part of it as well. But it just seems that our society is now focused so much on the commercially viable holidays, if you know what I mean. And since Thanksgiving isn't really one of those, it seems to get lost in the shuffle between two big ones, Halloween and Christmas. And so you see activities beginning, and this year with our extended late warm weather into the fall, it seemed pretty silly. I really went to the store one day about a week before Thanksgiving, and there was somebody outside, ringing the bell and with the bucket for donations, and he actually was playing a trumpet. He was playing Christmas songs, and it was 75 degrees out. And, you want to walk up and say, really? 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 We're a week away from Thanksgiving, and you're into Christmas stuff already. Time has a way of marching on in any case, as Mr. Patchinger commented in the announcements. In one way, it seems a long time already since the feast. In an email sent just this past week by the business manager from our feast site this year in Victoria, he mentioned that it was 5 weeks since we got home from the feast. And yet, that took me a bit by surprise until I looked at the calendar and I found out that he was right, because it seemed in some ways like there's been so much crammed into that space of time that it seemed like it was much longer than 5 weeks. Well, it's been a bit more than that now, but he had a point. Maybe because all of our lives seem so full, probably makes those lives rush past even more quickly. And I can't, Mr. Patchinger's comments were echoed in that as well. Last fall, I recall mentioning in a sermon before the feast, when I was talking about the fact that we were coming up on a season of the year with the fall holy days that would draw attention to the fact that you and I are different from those around us. It would mark us as being different. And yet, it's not as pronounced, perhaps, because they don't really know what we're doing. If you tell them you're going away for a week and ask your neighbors to, cut the grass for you while you're gone, or keep an eye out for packages being delivered or newspapers being delivered that shouldn't have been or whatever, Then if you get into any discussion, you might explain a little bit about what you're doing and where you're going. But since it's not a part of their lives, they just think, oh, how interesting. And for the most part, that's it. But it does mark us as being different. But I remember mentioning at that time that there would be coming in a few months' time what I call an echo. An echo of the time that marks us as different. And the echo time is here. We are now into another season that certainly marks you and marks me as being different from those around us. And it's not always easy to explain it. This is probably the worst time of year to try to explain to someone why you don't keep Christmas. Because they're so caught up in things. If you can engineer it, it's probably better in the summertime. You know, try it in July or August. That's a little simpler, a little easier. When they're not caught up in what they call the spirit of Christmas. The echo is here, and you and I have to get used to it, and we have to be ready for it. This time it's reversed, of course. They don't get why we don't keep a holiday that they are keeping, whereas in the fall, they didn't understand why we were keeping something they had no acquaintance with and weren't doing. But the constant bombardment of the awareness of the season is really starting to step up now. The ads are intensifying. You look at the TV listings, if you do that, and you see so many seasonal movies starting to come out. One of our young people in the church from Virginia was talking to several of us some time back about a discussion she had with a fellow college student about the fact that she doesn't keep Christmas. Found the conversation interesting. She told us that her friend was just incredulous when this came up. She was trying to explain she didn't keep Christmas. You know what the biggest question her college friend had was? Well, then, how do you get stuff? That was the question. Not, don't you believe in Jesus? That might be something that you and I would think we're a little more familiar with. You probably have gotten that before, as I have. But the question this friend had was, well, then how do you get stuff? She wanted to know, then, if this person just really got lots of presents after Christmas, or really tried to load up on her birthday and make sure that everybody knew when her birthday was. That was the biggest puzzle to her friend. How do you get stuff? How remarkably revealing about the mindset of some, at least, in our world, in our society, in our culture. How interesting, how selfish, surprising on one level and maybe unsurprising on another. But what never came up in this conversation, this young lady said, was any mention at all of what the day is supposed to be about by those who keep it. They claim, they think, they say it's about the birth of Jesus Christ, which, of course, it is nothing of the kind. I mean, in the weather of the last few days and what we're supposed to get in the next few days, would you want to be a shepherd out in the field with your flocks? And we haven't even gotten to, you know, temperatures like 15 or 12 or 0 or anything like that yet. Even now, it would be incredibly uncomfortable. And the Holy Land certainly has temperatures in this range throughout the wintertime. And sometimes, even occasionally, snow. Why are these things the way they are, brethren? Maybe I have a strange mind, but I'm always asking questions like, why? From the time I was a little boy, my dad and my mother before her death would say, you always were asking why. I remember one of the first questions our oldest child began to ask when she could first talk was, what's it? What's it? What's it? She always wondered what everything was. What's it? And so what's it? And it didn't matter what we explained, there was always another, what's it? What's it? What comes after that? And that's great because that's how children learn. I hope we too, at some level, have inquiring minds. But for too many people in our society, it's interesting, as this young lady found, her college friend was, Christmas isn't about worshiping God in any way, anyhow. It has nothing to do with that. I know that's what they say it's about. Some may even go to church on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day and feel all religious for a while. But Christmas has become so much more in our society about materialism and, as this young lady put it, getting stuff. How do you get stuff? Oh, there are appeals to nostalgia, to be sure. It's all around us in the stores, on the lawns, on the houses, on TV, the ads, the seasonal specials, like I said, the oldies of the movies that are always rebroadcast as we move into this time of year. White Christmas, I've heard Bing Crosby so many times, I'm really getting tired of it. It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart. Home Alone, you know, that was a classic probably 25, 28 years ago now, hard to believe. A Christmas Story, based in Cleveland, filmed here in Cleveland. Ralphie and the, you know, Red Ryder BB gun. And on it goes. Some of them are funny. Some of them are even touching, even apart from the seasonal connection. And of course, in this strange kind of an echo of a season that calls attention to the fact that you and I are different, we also find ourselves trying to deal with the well-intentioned. That would include those who ask you immediately, I don't understand. Don't you believe in Jesus? They're well-intentioned. They mean well. They are concerned, perhaps, for you. Those who wish you a Merry Christmas or make small talk conversation. Well, have you finished your shopping yet? Or are you ready for Christmas? Usually, of course, they're not interested in a long conversation. They really are not looking for you to dump years of study and research on them. They really do not want, you know, the 2.5-hour version of why you don't keep Christmas. So please be sensitive to that and be aware of it. Sometimes just a quick, no, I'm not ready for Christmas. Then they just think you're, you know, the Grinch or Scrooge or somebody like that. Or, I've done all the shopping I intend to do. Or, is anybody ever really ready for Christmas? Or something like that. Sometimes I just say thank you. I'm not thanking them for, you know, wishing them a return. I'm just thanking them for their thoughtfulness and for their concern. And most of the time, if you do that, they don't even notice that you haven't wished them a return of the greetings. And you just go on. Now, sometimes, of course, it's more appropriate to give a bit more of an answer. But all I'm saying is judge the moment and do not dump the whole load on them when they weren't really asking for it. That really wouldn't be appropriate. What's the point in going further? They don't want to have the result, like I said, of your years of research and study. They're just trying to be nice. But you know, there is somebody who needs to know the details of what it is we're doing and not doing at any given time of the year. Do you know who that is? You do. You do. You and I need to know why we do what we do, and just as importantly, why we don't do what we don't do. Because God's Word gives very specific instructions along both lines. Here's what I want you to do, and here's what I want you not to do. And it's important that you and I have both. And so while it may be true that most people who casually wish you a Merry Christmas or a Happy Holidays or whatever expression they use, while they're not looking for a biblical explanation of your observances, some few might. And if somebody does, what is your responsibility? And what is mine? We'll turn to 1 Peter chapter 3, a familiar section, but like so many familiar verses, what I find is that often we read a verse and we're familiar with the part that applies directly to the question we're facing. But you know, sometimes, brethren, even we, maybe sometimes after years in the church of God, can ignore one of the most important rules of Bible study. You know what one of those is? What we usually say, the first rule of Bible study is, get the context. Get the context. Do not what they call proof text, because there is where you run into the possibility of mistakes, where you lift something out of context. So make sure that what you're saying is understood in its context. 1 Peter 3 and verse 15 is the familiar verse. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense, the old King James said, an answer, to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you. And then it adds, Peter adds, with meekness and fear. It says, having a good conscience, that when they defame you as evildoers, those who revile your good conduct in Christ may be ashamed. We don't even often read verse 16. And that finishes the sentence, which is not as common for Peter as it is for Paul to have these long run-on sentences, as you heard in the sermonette today from Mr. Smith. But let's take a look at the context. Do we know the setting of Peter's words? Look at the general outline of the chapter, if I can put it that way. Let's back up right to the beginning. The first seven verses are actually instructions from Peter on the married state, that is, Christian marriages, how husbands and wives ought to treat one another. He says, wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives. There may be some instances where God calls, for example, a lady, and he does not call her husband to the knowledge of his truth. He says, in that case, there is a certain way to conduct oneself, and at least you can win their affection over. We're not necessarily talking about the fact that they would be called and have their minds open too. That's really dependent upon God's wishes and perhaps the response of the spouse. But he says they can be won over. They can be won to the fact that you have changed a way of life, that you're not the same person you were when they married you, but that they can see that this way of life means you are striving even more conscientiously to be a godly person in that relationship. It says, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear, the right kind of proper deep awe and respect. There was a fine article, this week's letter that Mr. Patching referred to from Mr. Bennett, the weekly update on Life, Hope, and Truth. Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Not that there's anything wrong with any of those items or any of those things. But he says, don't let your adornment be only that. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. You know, there's a strange thing that happens with the passage of time. The handsomest man you ever saw, ladies, the day he turned 98, didn't look that way. You understand what I'm saying? And guys, the most beautiful woman you could ever imagine in life, when she turns 100, it's just not going to be quite the same. Time has a way of changing things on the outside. You know what it doesn't change necessarily? Verse 4. Let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. That part of it. Now, guys, do not go around saying, I haven't been called Lord lately. What's going on here? That's kind of a cultural thing back at that time, that approach. The role in marriage may be similar in terms of the analogy of Jesus Christ and the church, which Paul makes very clear in his letters. Some things do change a bit with culture. Husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding. You know what, guys? That's probably one of our greatest challenges and weaknesses as husbands. We think, what is wrong with this person? She doesn't think like a man. Well, duh. God made us wonderfully different. You know, the French say, vive la différence. Maybe we should take a little hint from that. That God made us compatible and complementary for a reason. That was something that was pleasing to him, not to make us all the same. So dwell with them according to understanding, giving honor to the wife. That immediately knocks in the head too many cultural presuppositions of the past where women were treated very badly, almost more like property than anything else. You can't do that with this verse in your mind. How do you give honor to someone that you just don't treat with respect? As to the weaker vessel, in terms of just generally speaking, physically, the average man, or the most men, are stronger physically, structurally, bone density and everything else than most women. That's just a fact of construction. That's all it is. And as being heirs together of the grace of life in the ways that really count, we stand before God individually and in the same way before Him. That your prayers may not be hindered. So that's the basis of how the chapter begins. Then take a look at the next couple of verses. Finally, all of you be of one mind. This goes to everybody then, not wives and then husbands, everybody. Having compassion for one another. You heard about that in the sermonette today. Love as brothers. Be tender-hearted. Be courteous. Not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling. That is very much the way in our society. People sometimes train their children, well, I don't want you starting any fights, but if it starts, I want to make sure you know how to end it. Now, is that the approach God would have us take? I thought it was interesting this past week with the attack on the campus, the main campus of Ohio State down in Columbus. Perhaps you are aware of that. And the individual was killed by an on-campus police officer who was on the scene after he rammed his car into a group of pedestrians on the sidewalk and then pulled out a knife and stabbed two or three. We'll never know, perhaps, what goes through the mind that gets so distorted and twisted and demented in such a case until the resurrection, when perhaps you and I will be asked to help heal that person or others like him, and so that they too can have a chance to understand God's plan and be in His family. But, you know, I thought of the instruction that was given. It's a campus-wide movement. It's not just at OSU. It's in a number of places. They use the Twitter accounts and they activate it, and it just talks about run, hide, fight. Those three words, those are the instructions that are given. You don't try to duke it out with somebody, first of all. First of all, they tell them, run. If there's any way to avoid, get away, run. And then they say, hide. And then the fight instruction includes trying to incapacitate the attacker if there's any way they can. But I would suggest that by the time it gets to that point, if somebody's got a knife or a gun or a car, it's going to be pretty hard to do those things. But you know, our world, it seems, is focused on so many things that God says, that's not the way I want you to look at it. On the contrary, blessing. Knowing that you were called to this so that you may inherit a blessing. See, we're looking at it, the world looks at it evil for evil. You smack me, I'm going to slap you, you know. Reviling for reviling. You call me a dirty name, I'll call you two dirty names. And the whole thing escalates. God says, no, you learn to respond with a blessing because you're looking way beyond this immediate circumstance. You render a blessing because you are looking forward to try to inherit a blessing. You're trying to act in a manner very different from the world around you. You're trying to reflect the mind of Jesus Christ. And then he quotes from several sources, primarily the Psalms. He who would love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it, for the eyes of the Eternal are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers. But his face is against those who do evil. That's all leading up to our famous verse. Then he moves on into verse 13 and verse 14. This is what leads up to the famous verse we always quote. And who is he who will harm you if you become followers of what is good? You know, that applies on a couple of levels. Most of the time, if we are not belligerent, and cantankerous and impossible to get along with most of the time. Using the principle of the proverb about a soft answer turns away wrath. Most of the time that works. Not always, but most of the time it does. And wouldn't it be worth a shot so that you don't have a situation where several people get hurt? Wouldn't it be worth a try, maybe I should say, in our culture, in our world, using the term a shot, it may have different connotations. Wouldn't it be worth a try? But, he says, but even if you should. So even Peter acknowledges there are times when the soft answer approach may not work. Even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. And do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. That's what leads up to this verse. Isn't that an astonishing setting and a context? But, contrasting word, but instead of doing that, instead of being troubled or afraid of their threats, but sanctify God in your heart. Set Him apart for a special place in your mind and in your heart, and always be ready to give a defense. That's like a play on words when it's used that way. Your defense is not to put up your dukes and smash somebody's teeth out. Your defense to everyone who asks you a reason. We're going to talk about this. For the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. That's the context. And then the rest of the sentence, having a good conscience that when they defame you as evildoers, those who revile your good conduct in Christ may be ashamed. That may happen even on the spot. And it may happen later. And then he adds, for it is better, if it is the will of God, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. That ought to be obvious. In other words, if we suffer for doing evil, then what good has come of that on any level? You're in trouble with human beings and you're in trouble with God. His point is, if God allows these things from time to time, and you cannot study the history of mankind without realizing, brethren, there have been some pretty tough times in the history of God's people. Read the book of Revelation. Some of them have died in the faith. There have been martyrs in the history of the church. And prophecy tells us there will be again. Do we have faith in God even to not see things work out physically well? Peter's raising the issue, raising the question, as well he might. As you know, tradition had it that he was also crucified. And then he adds something else. The last part of the chapter adds even more. The context here is what kind of people we ought to be, even if what we say and do causes people to treat us badly. So, you know, when you put explaining why you don't keep Christmas into that mix, it's a pretty mild thing in general terms, wouldn't it be? But he goes on to say, for Christ also suffered once for sins, the just for the unjust. That goes without saying, doesn't it? That he might bring us to God. There was a greater purpose in Christ going through what he did. Are we willing to have the faith that there might be a greater purpose in things not always working out quite as smoothly as we might like? That he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit. God, of course, resurrected him by his power, which is the Spirit of God. By whom also he went and preached to the spirits in prison, who formerly were disobedient, when once the divine law and suffering waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight souls, were saved through water. We're not told exactly what this means or the details. It may be that the one who became Jesus Christ actually, in some fashion, gave some sort of personal exhortations to some of the people in the world before the flood. We don't know all the details. We don't know if he, at that time, even went and warned the demons to steer clear. Noah is doing this building, you stay out of it. You know, that would certainly understand, comprehend the spirits in prison thing. Restrained to the earth, cast back to the earth. We'll see. We'll find out a lot of things in the future. One thing we know, it is not what some in traditional Christianity try to claim, that during the time he was in the earth, that he was dead, that they claim his immortal soul went and talked to the demons. Not happening. When he was dead for 3 days and three nights. And he says, there is also an antitype which now saves us. Baptism. He says, that's not the removal of the filth of the flesh. It's not taking a bath to get rid of dirt. But the answer of a good conscience toward God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. When we are baptized, there is an analogy to the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. We go down in the waters of baptism. We are totally immersed. One of the reasons for total immersion is to picture Jesus Christ being buried in the heart of the earth 3 days and three nights. He was totally under, you know, he was dead. He was in the tomb. And we go completely under the water of baptism. And then it says in Romans 6 that we come up out of the waters to walk in newness of life. It's a different person. Paul later refers to it as the new man, or we could certainly say the new woman. A new life that has been given to us. To live not by our own standards and our own ideas and our own goals, but according to God's will. Through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, then speaking of him who has gone into heaven, is at the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers having been made subject to him. That's what that whole chapter is about. And then he starts the next one. Since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same mind. You see where he's going with all of this. You know, when you put it all into that context, what we go through for a few weeks is pretty minor, isn't it? Pretty minor. But the key is, do we know why we do what we do? Which is, of course, we keep the festivals and the holy days that God commands his people to keep. And they give us, we discovered, the amazing outline of his plan for humans. Do you ever stop and think about what a priceless bit of knowledge that is? Please don't let them become routine, brethren. Eagerly look forward to them every year because of the fact that it helps to entrench even further in our understanding what his whole purpose is. And it is a unique understanding. I was thinking last night as we were listening to In Accord, Mr. Kyla talking about some of the report that he made for the media department to the board of ministerial board of directors recently. It struck me how all-encompassing this understanding of this way of life is. And how, in one sense, how long it takes you to fully grasp it and get deeper and deeper and deeper all the time. Now, we begin wherever God opens our minds. If that happens to be at the age of 8, and you begin to understand what you're hearing a little bit, great. If it's at the age of 28, okay then. If it's at the age of 78, then that's God's doing. I remember baptizing a little lady in Canada years ago, and she was 83 years old when I baptized her. And she said, as we were counseling in the baptism, one of a number of baptismal counselings, which I typically do, she said, why would God call me now? She said, I just lost my husband of 60 years, and I started reading and studying these things after that. He never knew it. And I only could answer, I don't know the specific reason. I only know what I'm seeing as a minister of Jesus Christ and what I'm hearing as you explain the understanding that you are growing to have. I hear the fact and the results of God opening your mind. I said, I can't give you any more detail than that. I do know someone who can. You'll have to ask Jesus Christ in the resurrection. And she kind of smiled. And about, you know, a few weeks later, we baptized her at age 83. That's up to God. But it is something that is all-encompassing to our lives and minds and hearts, brethren. We have to come to that. This isn't just something we do for a couple of hours on Saturday. This is who we are. And it encompasses everything we say, think, and do. It helps partly explain why those who have not yet had their minds open to this very special truth cannot see. Because religion doesn't occupy that place in very many people's lives in our world. It is more typically something they do for an hour or so on Sunday morning. And then they go back to their own plans and lives and, you know, activities. Even for the rest of that day, there's no such thing that they understand as holy time. They don't know what that would be. You and I are very concerned about that. This is holy time. From the sunset last night till sunset tonight, it's not our time. It's God's time. Holy time. It's not something they understand. So sometimes these things happen to help us understand. It also explains to us, brethren, why the knowledge God gives us precludes celebrating anything else. Because what he gives us is complete in itself. It isn't something we can say, well, I'll start with that, and then I'll add this on to it. Because you know what that would tell God? Well, God, you did a good job, but you were missing something. You know, I'm just going to add to it. I'm going to improve the product a little bit, God. So I'm going to add this on. That's not what we want to be telling him. So how would you explain it to someone who truly wanted to know? Because, you know, you might have somebody say to you, as you made a few basic explanations, they might say, you know what, I agree with you. Christmas has become way too commercialized. They think they know why you don't keep it. Those would be the ones who might say, and might have a sign, a bumper sticker on their car that says, put Christ back in Christmas. You know, that's going to be very, very difficult because he was never there to begin with. Christmas is not about Jesus Christ. Oh, they put that name on it. But as you and I know from any amount of research, that's not where it came from. It was borrowed lock, stock, and barrel from the peoples of the Roman Empire. We call them pagan. The Latin word just meant rural or from the land. It was borrowed from the pagans of the Roman Empire, from their sun worship and Mithraism. And the Catholic Church, which was the prevailing church at the time, there were no Protestant churches yet, simply put names taken from the Bible on it to try to make it sound like something that these pagan peoples of the Roman Empire would be interested in doing too. Borrowed dates, borrowed customs, borrowed approaches, and just slapped Christian sounding names on it. But you know what? The old saying about, you know, if it walks like a duck, it waddles like it talks, it's probably a duck. Well, if it doesn't walk like a Christian or sound like a Christian or behave like a Christian or carry on the observances God gave Christians to do, it's not a Christian. That's just the way things are. Is the reason you don't keep Christmas because it's gotten way too commercialized? No. That's got nothing to do with it. Then there are those who would point out that, well, there are other non-Christian religions, and they are acknowledging, without even knowing it, one of the critical problems with professing mainstream Christianity. If you have to accept Jesus in some form before you die so that you go to heaven, what happens to good people who don't? That poses a real problem, doesn't it, for a mainstream Christian approach? It would make God such a terribly, terribly unfair monster to condemn them to ever-burning hell forever when they were good people, maybe better people than some people who supposedly would be allowed into heaven past St. Peter at the pearly gates, as the picture is commonly portrayed. There are problems. So some people point to that. Or atheists who don't recognize any kind of a higher power, think this life is all there is. And then some try to use that old separation of church and state dodge. They sort of try to level everything. Well, we have to give credence to all beliefs. So we have to honor all cultures are equally valuable. Nonsense. The thing is, first of all, that separation of church and state thing is a misunderstanding. Just to supply a little American history, The phrase nowhere appears in the Constitution, just so you're aware of that, as most people seem to think that it does. It came from a letter written by Thomas Jefferson as he attempted to explain his understanding of the First Amendment to the person he was writing the letter to. The First Amendment actually reads, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances." That's it. There's nothing in there about separation of church and state. All it says is that Congress is forbidden from setting up a national church, like the Church of England. That's what it was a reaction to. That was the intent of the Founding Fathers. Of course, secularism, which is, it has its moments, it kind of has its waves of up and down in our society. It has its funny moments. I know that I've related to you a story my wife experienced in her substitute teaching a number of years ago right here in Brunswick, where she was teaching, I think it was fifth grade, was that right? And she was standing around a group of fifth graders, maybe on the playground during recess or whatever, but she noticed these kids and all, she noticed this one girl was really kind of, she was the alpha female. I mean, she was dominating the activity, and she was talking, she was giving orders to everybody, and pretty soon my wife kind of sidles up closer, and she's grilling all of her classmates. And she came to my wife and she said, "Mrs. Johnson, they tell us we shouldn't say Merry Christmas to everybody. That we're supposed to say Happy Holidays so that we don't offend everybody." And my wife said, "You can say what you want. You can do what you want to do." She said, "Well, you know, I don't want to say that. I want to say Merry Christmas." And then she starts looking around at her friends and she starts grilling them. "Are you a Christian? Are you a Christian? Are you a Christian?" She's going around the circle. "Are you a Christian?" She finally came to this one little fella, and he says, they all, of course, got cowed into saying yes. And the one little fella says, "Well, yeah, but we don't go to church every Sunday or anything like that." And the one little fella besides my wife looks up at her and he says, "I think that's what they call a Methodist." I mean, it could have been any particular denomination. It didn't matter. I don't know whether he thought that was some sort of a method being described. I have no idea. You know, what's in the mind of a 10 or an 11-year-old? But we got the biggest kick out of that, that she tried to explain, because this little girl was saying, "You know, I think it's the Jews that are doing this to us all." And I went, no, honey. She says, if you want to identify, she said, "Can you say secular humanists?" You know. Well, you know, it's a long story, but she didn't know what to do with secular humanists, so then she started grilling her classmates to see if everybody was a Christian. Kids do say some funny things sometimes. But you know, that story has a point. In our society, from time to time, you'll see an attempt to secularize this time of year. And some people, maybe even in God's church, think, "Oh, that's a good idea." Well, you know, think about it. It comes and goes in waves. It tries to tone down the public celebrations of Christmas, taking away the public prominence that it has enjoyed, if you want to put it that way, in this country for years. But you know, the problem with that is this. It isn't about people finally realizing that the holiday is pagan in origin and shouldn't be kept. That's not why they're doing it. Do you know why they're doing it? They're doing it because they think it has something to do with Christianity. And what they want to do is remove any connection from what they think is Christianity from the public. It's of a kin with removing the Ten Commandments from, you know, courthouses and things like that. That's the concept. They think it has something to do with the Bible and God. Even though it doesn't, that's why they're approaching it that way. So for them, it's about being politically correct, not being spiritually and biblically correct. And brethren, that's where you and I have to come in. It is supposed by the masses to be a Christian holiday, therefore let's get rid of it. That's the approach this one segment takes. I agree we should get rid of it, but not for the reasons that mindset is pushing. That debate's about the wrong issue. And I come back to, brethren, why do we do what we do? And why don't we do the things we don't? What is it that I'm claiming you need to know? Well, let me put it this way. It's just this. We ought to be able to answer the question, where did people go wrong? How far back does it go? And I'm not going to go back to the Garden of Eden this time, so peace. You know, we'll save a couple of thousand years maybe, or 1,500 or whatever, 2,500. Where did people begin to worship God in the wrong way, even though they were calling upon His name? Turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 11 and see a rather interesting exchange. Deuteronomy 11 and verse 31 and 32. Most of you probably are aware that Deuteronomy is like a repetition of the highlights of Israel's journey from Egypt to the borders of the Promised Land. Deutero even means second or number two. It's like a second repetition of the law, or a repetition of the law, a second stating of the law. Notice the last two verses of Deuteronomy 11. Moses is talking and setting out these things to the Israelites, and he's passing on God's words. For you will cross over the Jordan. He wouldn't go, but they would. And go in to possess the land which the Eternal your God is giving you, and you will possess it and dwell in it. And then he says this, and you shall be careful to observe all the statutes and judgments which I set before you today. We're getting into the context of something again. We're leading up to a context of an important set of verses very soon. Moses speaks to the leadership of Israel just before his death, before they entered the Promised Land. At this point in their history, they've wandered 40 years. They were finally on the brink of beginning the conquest of the inheritance. And verse 32 set a theme that Moses would hammer at for this second generation. Be careful to follow the instructions you receive. Chapter 12 and verse 1 starts out the same way. These are the statutes and judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. Now, we might make an assumption here if we were really naive. The entire time the Israelites wandered through the wilderness having the tabernacle and the sacrifices, they naturally worshiped God faithfully all those 40 years, right? Like I said, if we were naive, we might make that assumption. And especially after the painful lesson of their parents losing the privilege of taking the land, the second generation would just naturally be very careful to worship God exactly as He said they should, right? Wrong. We're being naive. Look at verse 8 of chapter 12. You shall not at all do as we are doing here today. Every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. Isn't that kind of scary? Moses said, look, you're on the border of the Promised Land. You cannot go in with the mindset you've got right now. Because if you do, there will be trouble. Let's continue right here. Now, there may have been reasons. I mean, there were times when they were traveling constantly where the tabernacle was not even set up. That would have made it hard to carry out the daily sacrifices and so on. But the Israelites got into a very sloppy pattern. And you continue. It says, for as yet you have not come to the rest and the inheritance which the Lord your God is giving you. But when you cross over the Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God is giving to you, to inherit, and He gives you rest from all your enemies round about so that you dwell in safety, then there will be the place where the Lord your God chooses to make His name abide. There you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings of your hand, all your choice offerings which you vow to the Eternal. They were going to enter into a settled way of life finally. And they're to remember to do all that God said. If you were to look at verses 5, it talks about you shall seek the place where your God chooses to put His name. Verse 11, we read that phrase again, the place. Verse 14, in the place which the Lord chooses, in one of your tribes, there you'll offer your offerings. There you'll do all that I command you. Verse 18, talks about you must eat them, the freewill offerings, the tithe of your grain, in the place where he chooses. Verse 21, if the place is too far. And verse 26, he says, only the holy things which you have and your vowed offerings you shall take and go to the place which the Lord chooses. The phrase before the eternal is in verse 7, 12, twice in verse 18. It keeps cropping up too. When you add it up, this theme of before the eternal and the place shows up in 9 out of the 32 verses in this chapter. What would that do for the nation? Well, for ancient Israel, a single centralized place of worship was intended to do something. It was intended to purify and unite Israel, unify them in their worship of God. They would all be looking to the same place, somewhere God would designate, somewhere unique in the entire world. The tabernacle would be there, later the temple. God's presence would be understood to be there. You might say, well, it's Jerusalem, right? Not at first. Not for a long time. Very briefly, and only temporarily, it was in Gilgal until the land was subdued. And then you might say, kind of permanently temporarily, it was a tent after all, the tabernacle. It was in Shiloh, in the territory of Ephraim. You can read about that in Joshua 18. Well, what about Jerusalem, you might say? It would be, brethren, almost 500 years. 500 years almost. Before a temple was built in Jerusalem during the reign of King Solomon. That was a big moment in the history of Israel. We see it in 2 Chronicles chapter 6 with a dedication of the temple. Look at 2 Chronicles chapter 7 and read God's words to the people. 2 Chronicles chapter 7. After Solomon's prayer asking for wisdom and the prayer of dedication. Then it says, the Lord appeared to Solomon by night and said, I have heard your prayer, and I have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. When I shut up heaven and there's no rain, or I command the locusts to devour the land, or send pestilence among my people, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I'll hear from heaven, and I'll forgive their sin and heal their land. For my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to prayer made in this place. For now I have chosen and I have sanctified this house, that my name may be there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. As for you, if you walk before me as your father David did, and do according to all I've commanded you, and keep my statutes and my judgments, I'll establish the throne of your kingdom, as I covenanted with David your father. Interesting discussion going on. The temple became the place that the Israelites looked. This was the way in which God set apart the temple he'd built, set it apart for holy use. From that point on in their history, the temple became extremely important to Israel. Remember, there were people who would go and they would appeal for mercy on the horns of the altar, it said. It was a special place. Of course, later on, Israel rebelled. The northern tribes seceded from the house of David. 10 tribes went their own way, with a capital in Samaria. And only Judah, with remnants of Benjamin and Levi as well, continued to look to Jerusalem with the temple as the capital, the focal point of the nation, where God was. But you know what happened when Jeroboam took over as king of Israel? What happened? What was he afraid of? He was afraid that there would still be this pull in the minds of people that they would want to go back to keep the feast at Jerusalem, and that they would return to Rehoboam, Solomon's son. So you know what he did? He set up false places of worship. The group that went to Israel this past summer saw one of those false temples in Dan. He was worried about it. I won't turn there, but you can read about it in 1 Kings 12 and 13. You notice what else he did? He set up a special feast a month later. In other words, he decided to set up a holiday to worship God. Is any human being able to do that? Brethren, we don't believe that's the case. God warned about it so many times, but he established an alternate way to worship God. Does that sound like anything modern? It actually drew on the religion of the Egyptians because he had calves, and the Canaanites making shrines on the high places. And he moved the timing a month later. Do you see any resemblance to Christmas? Moving things of saying they happened at a certain time when they couldn't possibly have happened at a certain time. What happened to the northern tribes? Well, the separation became permanent. The corruption was lasting. They were severed from God. They no longer worshipped in any way that even came close to what he had given them. They forsook the place of worship and they lost their identity. For about 250 years, Judah more or less clung to certain things. You couldn't really say they were totally faithful, but more or less. At least they acknowledged the patterns God had given them, even if they were straying in their lives. But finally, they departed too. And you find in 2 Kings 21, during the reign of the wicked King Manasseh, that God had had enough. And he decided to withdraw from his people. You know, it was just a building if God's presence wasn't there. Even then, in his mercy, God didn't totally withdraw. Sometimes the priests were faithful, sometimes they weren't. Even in Christ's day, despite the spiritual corruption of the priesthood, Jesus Christ still called the temple my Father's house, didn't he? In John chapter 2 and verse 16. But you know, there's another interesting scripture in the Gospel of John. It's in chapter 4, which begins to move us to our own time right now. You're thinking, wow, I thought he was never going to get there. John 4. Interesting conversation. Jesus strikes up a conversation with a Samaritan woman at the well. He tells her so much about her own circumstances that she's convinced he's a prophet in verse 19 of John 4. And she says something important to him. Verse 20, she says, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is a place where one ought to worship." Now, there's a lot of history in there. They were still talking about a place, do you see? She says, "Our fathers say it's on this mountain. You Jews say it's Jerusalem." They viewed themselves, the Samaritans were actually Gentiles. They were not Israelite. They had been brought in centuries earlier by the Assyrians after they conquered the territory of the northern kingdom. You can read about it in 2 Kings 17, verses 24 to 41. But they viewed themselves as a kind of a, well, I guess you'd say theoretical and theocratic and theological descendants of the Israelites, the original inhabitants, because they were in that territory. And so she said, "Our fathers." But the alternate worship that had been set up by Jeroboam was still influencing them. "You Jews say, but our fathers say." The Samaritans claimed this was the mountain on which Moses told Israel to build an altar and engrave the Ten Commandments and put them there. The scripture says it was Mount Ebal, but the Samaritan claims that that was a mistranslation. Yes, they argued about translations back in the first century too. They actually said it was Mount Gerizim where they built the temple. Christ had news for the Samaritan woman. Look at it. Verse 21. Jesus said, "Woman, believe me. The hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father." He said, "I got news for you. It isn't about a place. It's about where God was. You worship what you don't know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship Him." Not at a place. An obedient, yielded spirit. God is spirit. He's not physical. He doesn't have to have a house so He doesn't get wet when it rains. And those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth. Brethren, when you think about it, doesn't that last verse just restate what Moses told the Israelites clear back in Deuteronomy 12? You shall be careful to observe everything that He commands you. That was what was most important. Following God's instructions in spirit and in truth. That's what He cares about. That's why we do what we do. And most importantly, why we don't do anything else. That's why we need to know the answers to those questions, even if nobody ever asks us. You need to know. Peter said, "Be ready, fine, be ready. Where does Christmas fit with all that, since that's the season of the year we're approaching? Well, when people say something like, well, you know, I know Jesus wasn't really born then, but I do it to honor him. Do you see the fallacy of that now? They cannot understand unless God opens their mind. It isn't their fault. There will come a time when God gives them the knowledge the way he gave it to you and to me. And that'll be a wonderful time for them. But in the meantime, you and I do know. And we are responsible. And we are accountable. It doesn't honor Jesus Christ. It doesn't honor God if it isn't what he said to do. What of that place that had been so important? Well, God built his church in the New Testament, we know. Founded it on the day of Pentecost, 31 AD. The temple was still functioning at the time. In fact, early on, you can read a verse in the book of Acts that says in verse 7 of chapter 6, Acts 6 verse 7 says, a great many of the priests were obedient to the faith. So you had an odd situation where the Levitical priests at the temple were part of the true church of God. There was nothing particularly wrong with them continuing to carry out the instructions that had been given before, even though it was no longer spiritually required. That's not the case with Christmas. It was never required, instructed by God. But one whole book of the New Testament would gently help the early church to see that the physical place was not what God was looking at. It's the book of Hebrews. Very interesting book. I believe this was the topic of FI Online last year, and I'm sure it's still there in the archives. Or if not last year, 2 years ago. I lose track of these things. In Hebrews chapter 8, we read some interesting words. Now this is the main point of the things we are saying. Hebrews 8:1. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. A minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which God built, not man. Solomon built the temple. And there were, it was flattened, it was destroyed. It was rebuilt during the time of Haggai and Zechariah, but not anywhere near the same scale. And then he says, for every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, therefore it's necessary that this one should also have something to offer. For if he were on earth, he wouldn't be a priest. Why? Because Jesus Christ was not a Levite. He was a Jew. Since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, that is the law of the Levitical priesthood. They serve the copy and the shadow of the heavenly things. As Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle, he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. Brethren, there's a commonality in God's instructions. The commonality is, here's what I want you to do. Do it exactly the way I tell you. And he has that right. You know, just like you as parents, when you're dealing especially with young children, you know, you got a child 3 or 4 years old. Obviously, when they get older, they need more explanation. But for a young child, the answer, because I said so, is entirely an appropriate response. I'm the parent, you're the child, not the other way around. Sometimes modern parents get that mixed up to the confusion and hurt of everybody. Side point, sorry. He goes on to say, but now he has obtained a more excellent ministry, inasmuch as he is the mediator of a better covenant, established on better promises. The covenant with Israel was the concept that God would be their God and they would be his nation physically. They would have the chance to demonstrate to the world what it meant to be a nation being obedient to God. They terribly fell down on that job. The New Testament church operates according to a different covenant, based on the same law, with many of the same common elements, including the days of worship, but with an enhanced or a different meaning, now reflecting the fact that our Savior has come and died for our sins. Chapter 9, verse 11 says, Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation. Not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood he entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies for purifying the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? For this reason, he's the mediator of the new covenant, by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, that those who are called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. What is the promise of the new covenant? Is it to inherit a physical promised land? Nope. It's not about a place. It's to be in the family of God. To be a child of God forever. But you know what? The attitude of obedience is still there. Chapter 12 of Hebrews makes that clear, and I read it recently in a sermon. Talks about in verse 15, looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. Talks about you have not come, verse 18, to the mountain that may be touched and burned with fire. That was Old Testament Israel's experience. Blackness and tempest and darkness. It says you've come, verse 22, to Mount Zion and the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn registered in heaven. That'd be the book of life. To God, the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect. We know that when people die, we have no immortal soul, but the spirit in man, the human spirit, God is a recorder, and he guards that carefully until the time of the resurrection, when he will energize them with a new life, a spirit life. See that you don't refuse him who speaks, he says. Read the rest of the chapter. Obedience is still there. Obey what God says to do. How important is it? Hebrews 12 makes it absolutely clear. God has prepared, I guess you'd say, in a way, a place for his faithful, but it's not a physical place. Hebrews 11:16 spoke of a heavenly city, not physical Jerusalem. Look at chapter 13 of Hebrews and 13 verse 14. It says, here we have no continuing city, Hebrews 13:14, but we seek the one to come. Hebrews 13:14, we have no continuing city. It isn't that Jerusalem is now the only place where God is. The temple, whatever is left of it, whatever might be set up again, whatever might be done in the way of sacrifices before Christ's return, that's not what it's about. God is calling to a way of life and an understanding. And he holds out the potential of a future in his family. The place, as important as it once was to Israel, was only a means to an end. The most important part of Moses' instruction to Israel was not so much to set apart a place of worship as it was to show them that they were to be set apart as God's people. Even then, in Leviticus 19 and verse 2, God entreated them. He said, "Be you holy, for I, your God, am holy." That was the point. And he lamented in Deuteronomy 5:29, "Oh, that there were such a heart in them, a heart of obedience." Now we can go back to Deuteronomy 12. With a lot of background, I grant you. I hope I didn't lose you too early in the process. Now we can go back to Deuteronomy 12 with all kinds of context. We know from the early verses of the chapter that we already read, or that we've seen anyway, verse 1. If we go on to verses 2, 3, and 4, "You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains, on the hills, and under every green tree. You'll destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, burn their images with fire, cut down the carved images of their gods, and destroy the names from that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things." We don't look for how others do, whatever they do. They were not to incorporate those customs. But you know, brethren, that's exactly where the customs of Christmas have come from. That's what it is. It was the customs of the pagan. The word just means the people of the land, or from the country, or rural, from the pagan peoples of the land of the Roman Empire in the 3rd and 4th centuries. That's where it came from. That's what the established church did back then. They wanted to make it easier for the people of the country, the pagans, to worship the Christian God the way they said to do it. So if they worshiped the sun god, they were told about the Son of God. If they included a day for the dead in their customs, they were told, well, fine, go ahead and keep that same day, but think about the saints in heaven and the sinners in hell and call it All Saints Day. And the evening before you call All Hallows Eve. Wonder what that changed into. Halloween. Sound familiar? The result? Well, the Catholic Church spread that view of Christianity throughout Europe, the British Isles, Mexico, Latin America, and the world. Later on, with the Protestant Reformation, they borrowed heavily from the same customs and spread theme and variations to North America, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and so many other places around the world. But from the beginning, I asked earlier, where did people go wrong? They went wrong clear back when God called a people to himself. From the start, we can't do that. God said his true people must have nothing to do with mixing pagan customs with his instructions. The truth itself would identify them and set them apart from others. Jesus Christ even prayed that the night before his death. You know the truth shall make you free. And then he also said in John 17:17, set them apart through your word. Your word is truth. Why then, brethren, don't we keep Christmas? Because it isn't true. And we can explain why if asked, and that is reason enough. It's reason enough for us to know why, if we are called upon to explain kindly and gently. You might say, I've used the expression before and it seems to help some people, you might say, we model ourselves not on 4th century Christianity, which refers to Council of Nicaea, Council of Laodicea, and some of those councils of the Catholic Church in the 4th century where they established pagan doctrines and called them Christian. We don't follow 4th century Christianity. We follow 1st century Christianity. The record of the early church, 1st century, not 4th. That's what we're trying to do. We don't keep Christmas because it's gotten too commercialized. That's not the reason. It isn't because it's not politically correct or because we think we must value all religions and customs equally. In fact, we especially repudiate the fact, the idea of valuing all customs and religions equally. What we do is cling to what God tells us in his word. We don't go around beating people over the head with it. We don't become obnoxious with it. We understand that it is a humbling mercy from God to have given us the understanding now. And we look forward to the time when we might be able, with his blessing and help and mercy, to teach. And we try to follow the same way of life God revealed to Israel through Moses, the way that Jesus Christ taught his disciples as an expansion based on the same things. And we desire most of all to worship him in spirit and in truth. Now we can read the last few verses of Deuteronomy 12 that most of us are so familiar with in connection with worship. Deuteronomy 12:29, when the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I'll do the same. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. And then he cites some of the worst cases. For every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they've done to their gods, including they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Well, we don't do that anymore, do we? We just murder millions of unborn children every year. And we call it a medical procedure. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it, nor take away from it. That, brethren, is why we don't keep Christmas. Or even take any notice in that sense of the birth of Christ, which we can't anyway because we don't know exactly when it was. He doesn't tell us. to observe or celebrate that. He tells us to remember his death till he comes. We believe in doing whatever God reveals to us we should do, and we believe in not doing any of the things that he doesn't instruct us to do. Are we as careful as Moses encouraged the Israelites to be? We certainly need to be. It's a good time and a good season to be aware of that and sure of that fact, and to long for the day when everyone will understand God's beautiful plan. Postscript, P.S. Is it too early to say that Passover is only 127 days away?